And I'm Liam Delta.
This is Maddie Bowden.
I'm Alex Collins, KBOO News.
I'm Michael Newman, KBOO News.
I'm Courtney Dillard, KBOO News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, part four of KBOO's ongoing Trojan nuclear plant retrospective. A former campaign official for President George W. Bush was sentenced to prison for campaign dirty tricks. And in the country of Nepal, they finally eliminated the king's power, but insurgents appear to have taken over the country.
And in the human cost of occupation in Iraq, as of today, there have been 2,454 officially acknowledged deaths of American soldiers, with as many as 48,000 others wounded. IraqBodyCount.org reports as many as 39,344 civilians have been reported killed by military intervention in Iraq. Meanwhile, other experts estimate that the true Iraq body count may be as high as 250,000 dead.
Meanwhile, a new poll released today showed President Bush's approval rating has dropped to 22%.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, May 18th, 2006. I'm Eduardo de Landeros Tierra.
Good evening. I'm Marlies Franklin. In Congress, U.S. Representative Greg Walden's controversial bill to speed the ability of federal forest land managers to make timber salvage decisions is now on its way to the Senate. The Forest Emergency Recovery and Research Act, H.R. 4200, was co-authored by Representatives Brian Baird, Democrat from Washington State, and Stephanie Herseth, Democrat from South Dakota. The bill became an issue earlier this year when Oregon State University officials tried to censor a graduate student's research that showed post-fire logging is harmful for the environment. Joseph Vail, campaign director for the Ashland-based Klamath Siskiyou Wildland Center, an environmental group opposed to the bill, says the bill gives corporations a blank check to clear cut.
A unique anti-war event is scheduled in Portland this weekend. KBOO's Jessica Rink Perry reports.
This Saturday, members of the new organization Combatants for Peace and Iraq Vets Against the War will talk about their experiences serving in Palestine and Iraq, as well as what they are doing to challenge their government's policies. Speakers will discuss their experiences serving as part of a military occupation, what moved them to refuse military service, and how they are working against war now. The event takes place this Saturday, May 20th, at 7 p.m. at St. Francis Church at Southeast 12th and Pine in Portland. Speakers will include Dan Tsayer, a former soldier in the Israeli infantry, and Joe Hatcher, a U.S. Army veteran. Sayer was jailed in Israel in 2003 after he refused, as a conscientious objector, to serve in the compulsory Israeli army. Since then, he has been active in the organizations Courage to Refuse and Combatants for Peace. Hatcher served in Iraq for over a year and is an active member of Iraq Veterans Against the War. KBOO had the chance to speak with them earlier this week. Tsayer is part of a large but seldom heard peace movement in Israel, comprised of Israeli and Palestinian former soldiers. They are speaking to students in the Middle East with a message of hope.
And today, instead of fighting each other, we're having a dialogue. And we try to show it, to promote the dialogue, to promote peace by talking with some young people in high schools, both in Israel and in Palestine, and to show that dialogue is possible.
Tsayer represents a side of the Middle East that is forgotten in the United States, where suicide bombings make for eye-grabbing headlines.
The peace movement in Israel and in Palestine are quite big, and no one hears about it on the CNN, when they read the newspapers.
In spite of selective news coverage, Joe Hatcher believes it's not a matter of informing the American public of the nature of the occupation in Iraq, but of rallying Americans to action.
We are currently involved in the illegal occupation of a sovereign nation to secure its natural resources.
Hatcher has numerous complaints to level against our government's treatment of its soldiers and the support they actually receive.
The lack of proper equipment and training, The health issues that veterans face, including depleted uranium, post-traumatic stress, white phosphorus, larium, complete disregard for international law, soldiers that have been affected by the war profiteering, stop loss, people whose families have been destroyed by deployments too often and too long.
He says Americans know what is happening in Iraq and need to make their feelings known to their representatives in Congress.
Right now, I believe that the American public should be making those who they've elected aware that they're no longer serving the public's needs and wants.
Hatcher is calling attention to the realities of the Iraq War in hopes that Americans will be motivated to seek new leadership in the November elections.
And we need a social awakening to where we can retake our government and we can retake our lives. There was a time when the government was afraid of the people, not vice versa, and we need to return to that.
I'm Jessica Rink Perry reporting for KBOO News.
Oregon National Guard officials say they will edit or replace a recruiting sign at the National Guard Armory. Protesters camped nearby removed a display of cardboard coffins, including some small ones symbolizing dead Iraqi children. They also removed boots and shoes symbolizing the Iraq War's toll. The two sides have been trying to accommodate each other since Sunday. The protesters objected to a sign reading, 100% tuition paid. Major Chris Reese said the sign will be changed to reflect an annual cap of $4,500, or it might just say, join the team. Protesters said they removed their displays because they detracted from the main message, which was truth in recruiting. Eduardo?
This Sunday, May 21st, at 7 in the morning, PGE plans to blow up the main cooling tower of the mothball Trojan nuclear plant. The blast is expected to last 8 seconds, but the Trojan story has lasted for years, and it's not over yet. All this week, the KBOO News department presents a retrospective on the ill-fated plant, and tonight, KBOO Spencer Raymond presents a vox populi of a few of the activists who spent almost 20 years trying to shut down Trojan.
Well, every nuclear reactor is basically an atomic bomb with the clutch in.
The plant was built with about half the earthquake capacity that it was designed to have. That PGE's engineers, a firm called Prescouti out of San Francisco, a world-class firm, looked at Trojan and said that basically if you sneezed it would fall over, and that it was completely misdesigned, and so that no one could even calculate what kind of earthquake resistance it would have, but that it wouldn't be good.
Started a movement called the Sunday Nuclear Boycott, or SNUB, and the idea was for people to light a candle in their window and turn out their lights on Sunday night in protest of nuclear power and the operation of the Trojan nuclear power plant.
Unbeknownst to anybody at the time the plant was built, we live in the most menacing earthquake zone in the world. We have the Cascadia subduction zone just off the Oregon coast, and every 300 years or so, it gives way and gives us earthquakes as large as the planet knows how to generate.
The sighting of a reactor in the terribly geologically active and unstable area, like the Cascades and the Columbia River Basin, is just ludicrous.
And then we performed a 9-week march through the most populated area of Oregon. We went down the coast of Oregon, over to the Willamette Valley at Florence into Eugene, and then all the way up the Willamette Valley to Portland, and we ended at Trojan. That was a 9-week walk, and we had a display of an alternative energy exhibit on wheels on the back of a flatbed trailer that followed us around.
The first and foremost vulnerability of every single nuclear reactor in the world is that they depend on off-site power for the running of everything on site, like the cooling for the reactor core.
You know, we were plugged into a national effort, but the grunt work was Oregonians.
During the whole period of time when we were fighting to shut down Trojan, we were being told that, well, we couldn't shut down Trojan because we need that energy. You know, Portland and Oregon absolutely couldn't survive without Trojan shut down, and as far as I know, Portland's still there. But ultimately, public involvement highlights issues which otherwise would not be highlighted. Maybe Trojan never would have shut down if it weren't for the fact that suddenly the spotlight was pointed at nuclear power, and so regulators had to act when maybe they would not have otherwise.
It's well known that the radioactivity of a reactor is sufficient to activate the concrete of cooling towers. Even, you know, they may also be contaminated, which is a different issue, but simply the proximity to the amount of radiation activates the concrete. And so that material, even if they claim, oh, it never got contaminated, is radioactive. And as they implode, as in any explosion, you're going to be creating dust and small particles. There's no way that's all going to be contained on site. And then there's the big question, what are they going to do with it? And I wish I could answer that question for you, but, you know, where is this going to go? However, it should be done, you know, with remote imaging and shared on film. I really think it's a mistake for people to turn out and potentially get covered with that powder and dust.
I don't think it's dangerous to blow it up. The cooling tower itself is not radioactive. I think it should be left there as a monument to human folly. I mean, it's, you know, it's a great story, and every time you drive to Seattle, you have a chance to tell the children the story about how you know, history made a wrong turn.
That was Portland attorney Greg Cafuri speaking to Cable's Spencer Raymond. Also speaking were former Portlanders Mary Olson of the Nuclear Information and Resource Center in Washington, D.C., and Abram Friedman of the Canary Coalition in South Carolina. Tune in all this week for ongoing Trojan implosion coverage. And don't miss the Cable Evening News next Monday night, May 22nd, for exclusive coverage of the implosion and its after effects.
A school advisory panel has recommended closing, moving, or merging more than a dozen schools in Seattle for the 2007 school year. This is the district's second try at closing schools. It backed down last year because of parent opposition. Seattle has the largest school district in the state with 100 schools and about 46,000 students. The district says closing and consolidating schools should save nearly $5 million a year. The district is forced to act because revenue for next year is expected to fall $15 million short of spending plans.
This month in Portland, a nonprofit called Men's Spirit opens wellness classes designed to improve the health of gay men. Organizer Bart Church spoke about the project with the Cable News this week and talked about why this focus is a matter of life and death.
Because men, and especially queer men, are getting things like HIV, syphilis, gonorrhea, suicide, and drug and alcohol addiction at far higher rates than women or general folks in the population. So we've got some epidemics of infectious disease, and we've also got some kind of stress and homophobia-related illnesses that we're seeing. Like 90% of all our syphilis cases in the last few years have been among gay men. About 50% of our gonorrhea cases have been among gay men. About 70% of our new HIV cases have been among gay men. Huge proportion of suicides, huge percentage of drug and alcohol addiction. And we believe that homophobia and sexism make men not focus on their health and have to cope with stress in ways that are not good for them. So we're trying to create a wellness program for men that says you matter and your health matters. We have basically four wellness programs. One is a Healing Touch program where we're providing various events each month teaching men healing touch techniques and how to communicate around healing touch. And then we have another program called Yoga and Meditation, where we're encouraging men to just set goals for themselves and then use yoga and meditation classes as a way of reaching their goals. And then we have some more fun events our social play, communication events, men's spirit pajama party. We have workshops on masculinity. We have workshops on all kinds of things that help people realize that they can be much more creative, much more playful, and much more social than they have been in online hookups, bars, and bathhouses, where the way people are interacting is very kind of not very health-producing and wellness-focused. We're trying to provide alternatives that are drug, alcohol, smoke-free, fun, creative, and really promote whole wellness. So, and then our last thing we do is provide a lot of information and referral to men about wellness, so that if they're looking for outdoor hiking events, there's a wonderful organization for men in town that's not us, but that we refer them to. Or if they want to play feminist anarchist football, there's a group in town that does anarchist feminist football. And we refer people to really fun events and programs that aren't sponsored by us, but that follow in our values of promoting wellness in mind, body, and spirit. Well, one thing I would add is that two nonprofit organizations, QLANT and Love Tribe, got together to create this Men's Spirit program to really promote wellness among men in the Portland metro area. And, yeah, we've been going now for 2.5 years, and it's, you know, it's really amazing to say to men, your health matters, your life matters, and you can support one another in being well. And it's a very powerful thing. It reminds me a lot of the early women's health movement back when feminism was realizing that women needed to take care of their own bodies and create a community around taking care of their health. Well, in a lot of ways, men have been 30 years behind in that kind of movement. And so we really see it, and I just wanted to say thank you to the women's health movement for kind of creating the community organizing systems that we've studied and are trying to use in a men's context, with dealing with almost exactly the same issues of sexism and homophobia and how it damages people's whole self-esteem and sense of wellness.
That was Bart Church with QLANT. And for more information on the wellness classes, you can call 503-734-6508 or go to www.lovetribe.org.
Morrow County voters have approved a measure to create a race car complex in eastern Oregon. The measure creates a speedway district and allows an 8% tax on tickets and retail sales inside the district, which covers about 35 square miles next to Interstate 84 and 5 miles west of Boardman. Most of the money generated will pay for infrastructure and roads. The sponsors plan a grandstand to seat 81,000 people with 60 luxury suites and 4 different kinds of speedways. The development could include an RV park and campground, a go-kart track, and retail and restaurant space. Oregon International Speedway now says it can solicit sanctioning bodies such as NASCAR and get race dates.
The city of Seattle is asking itself something really important. If the public financing of sports stadiums is good public policy, deciding whether to spend hundreds of millions of dollars on sports teams or to fund low-income housing, classrooms, transportation, and open spaces. Martha Baskin reports.
Okay, so the targeted audience was a no-show on the steps of City Hall, but that didn't stop community organizers from staging a mock farewell to the Seattle Sonics. The Sonics and their owner, Starbucks CEO Howard Schultz, want the city to pony up $220 million to renovate Key Arena. They also want a bigger revenue cut. Organizers say the money could be better spent renovating schools, building low-income housing, and repairing the city's overstressed highways and bridges. Rick Harris, editor of Real Change, Seattle's paper for the poor and homeless, noted that income for the top 20% in the city rose by 56% last year. That's a problem, he said, because income for the poorest fell. Harris said he thought about it and came up with a better idea.
So what I think we need to do is take that $200 million or so and invest it in the Seattle Maritime Fund for the poor and homeless.
The community organizer's primary goal was to encourage the mayor and city council to not give in to the team's demands. The last two times sports teams demanded big money, and in spite of the public voting against it, the city and the state caved in. Organizer Rachel Myers.
I think that's why the Sonics are asking. I think they think they can get that. And we're trying to give the city backing and say, we've done it twice. It was a bad idea probably those times, and it's really bad idea the third time.
Seattle Weekly columnist Rick Anderson, who's written extensively on the issue, says the total cost to taxpayers with interest could be between $400 and $500 million.
Essentially, what we have is a group of millionaires. They're actually, their personal worth is probably $2 billion, so they could write a check for this if they wished.
The Sonics' principal owner, Starbucks CEO Howard Schultz, has proposed to contribute $18.3 million towards the new arena. Anderson says that at that level, the millionaires would be chipping in about 4.5% in return for a master lease to take all the profits from the public facility. But the tide may be changing. The state has refused any funding, and the city council and mayor have told the Sonics' ownership that they have to come up with considerably more money, at a minimum $100 million. It's an unusual stand. Again, Rick Anderson.
First time that in this city where this kind of thing has happened, most cities are held hostages by these professional franchises who immediately raise threats and say they're going to move and it's going to kill the economy and a lot of things that just aren't true.
For Free Speech Radio News, this is Martha Baskin reporting in Seattle.
A senior official in George W. Bush's re-election campaign was sentenced to 10 months in prison on yesterday for his role in suppressing votes 4 years ago in a key U.S. Senate race. It's a scandal that, according to Democrats, may involve the White House. James Tobin is one of three Republican campaign operatives convicted in a phone-jamming scheme designed to keep New Hampshire Democrats from voting in a 2002 election. He was convicted in December of two telephone harassment charges. Prosecutors had asked for a two-year sentence. U.S. District Judge Stephen McAuliffe described the crime as, quote, extremely serious, end quote, and a threat to the U.S. political tradition of free and fair elections. Democrats want an investigation into 22 telephone calls made by Tobin and New Hampshire Republican Party officials to the White House on November 5th and 6, 2002. They say they believe national Republican officials may be involved in the scheme.
A Pentagon investigation into the death of Iraqi civilians last November in the Iraqi city of Haditha will show that U.S. Marines killed innocent civilians in cold blood, Representative John Murtha, Democrat of Pennsylvania, said today. Murtha held the news conference to mark the 6 months since his initial call for redeployment of U.S. forces from Iraq. Iraqis in the town of Haditha say U.S. Marines deliberately killed 15 unarmed Iraqi civilians, including seven women and three children. It was a case featured on Democracy Now! Last month. One young Iraqi girl said the Marines killed six members of her family, including her parents. Military officials have told NBC News that the U.S. Marine Corps' own evidence appears to show Murtha is right. Three U.S. Marine officers, commanders in Haditha, have been relieved of duty, and at least 12 Marines in all are under investigation for what would be the worst single incident involving the deliberate killing of civilians by U.S. military in Iraq.
Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice today assured two senators that she supports legislation to curb the spread of shoulder-fired missiles worldwide. Senator Barack Obama, Democrat of Illinois, said Rice voiced support for the bill during a 45-minute meeting with him and Senate Foreign Relations Committee Chairman Richard Lugar, Republican of Indiana. They are co-sponsors of the measure expected to be voted in committee next week. The legislation calls for the United States to provide help to countries seeking to secure, remove, or eliminate stocks of the shoulder-fired missiles. It would authorize about $524 million in fiscal 2007 for non-proliferation, anti-terrorism, and other activities, and requires the Secretary of State to issue a report to Congress on conventional arms threat reduction within 180 days of becoming law.
More on weapons. The U.S. military in Iraq has begun using a laser device mounted on soldiers' M4 rifles to so-called dazzle Iraqi drivers who fail to heed the warnings to stop at checkpoints. Lieutenant Colonel Barry Venable, a Pentagon spokesman, said the laser device is not a weapon because it is not intended to injure. He noted that they are a warning device intended to minimize unnecessary casualties. If used properly, he says the laser is not blinding. So-called tactical laser devices have been controversial in the past. A protocol to the Geneva Convention bans the use of these lasers that cause blindness, and many human rights groups have protested previous U.S. attempts to employ such weapons. A decade ago, for example, the experimental use of tactical laser devices by the U.S. Marines in Somalia was curtailed at the last minute for humane reasons, according to the New York-based Human Rights Watch, which called their use repugnant to the public conscience in their 1995 report.
Motions to dismiss a lawsuit against AT&T for handing millions of its customers' calling records over to the National Security Agency's surveillance program without a warrant were heard in San Francisco federal court yesterday. The Electronic Frontier Foundation is alleging AT&T broke the law. Both AT&T and the Bush administration have asked the courts to dismiss the suit and withhold evidence in the interest of national security. Christina Anastad reports.
Federal Judge Vaughn Walker rejected AT&T's motion to withhold evidence from the Electronic Frontier Foundation in its suit against the telecom for handing over customer calling records to the National Security Agency without a warrant. Judge Walker placed the documents under seal. Whistleblower and retired AT&T technician Mark Klein gave the Electronic Civil Rights Group the documents that outline AT&T's cooperation with the National Security Agency in spying on millions of AT&T customers calling and email records. Jim Brosnahan is the attorney for Mark Klein.
All the emails, all the telephones that are connected to the emails, and all the web browsings go through the AT&T facility in those cities, and it goes into a secret government room. What he knows has never been classified, never been declared top secret. He's not cleared. He was never cleared. Everything that he did all this time was never top secret.
The suit is largely based on Klein's documents that show the NSA equipped secret rooms at AT&T offices in San Francisco, Seattle, San Jose, Los Angeles, and San Diego to wiretap AT&T customers. The foundation claims AT&T engaged in criminal activity, but AT&T is claiming immunity. Mark Bien, spokesperson for AT&T, says the company engaged in no wrongdoing.
AT&T does not provide customer information to law enforcement agencies or government agencies without legal authorization. We have an obligation to assist law enforcement and other government agencies responsible for protecting the public welfare, whether it be an individual or the security interests of an entire nation. If and when AT&T is asked by government agencies for help, we do so strictly within the law and under the most stringent conditions.
The Bush administration is also seeking to dismiss the lawsuit against AT&T, invoking a state secret privilege. The federal assistant attorney general, Carl Nichols, claims documents used in the lawsuit would violate the interests of national security. Nichols asked the court to dismiss the suit and close the hearings to the public. But foundation attorneys argue the information used in the suit against AT&T is public knowledge and not a state secret. Attorney Cindy Cohen says spying on millions of citizens is more of a threat to national security interests.
I think it's pretty hard to say that the wholesale turning over of millions of innocent Americans' communications is at all necessary to help keeping us secure. In fact, I think the reports that we're getting back out of the government about this is, to the extent that that's happening, it's undermining their ability to figure out who the bad people are, because this flood of information, you know, more haystacks doesn't help you find the needles.
Judge Walker declined the assistant attorney general's motion to close the public hearings. Arguments on whether the suit against AT&T would violate state secret privilege will be heard on June 23rd. Reporting from San Francisco, I'm Christina Anastad.
The Senate Committee on Commerce, Science, and Transportation held a first hearing today to introduce the Communications Act Reform Bill, which aims to profoundly change the way the telecommunications industry is regulated in the U.S. One of the bill's most debated provisions deals with Internet neutrality and the concern that the cable industry would privatize the Internet by charging more for preferential data delivery. From Washington, D.C., Anastasia Ganastitskaya.
The Communications Act Reform Bill, sponsored by the Republican Senator Ted Stevens from Alaska and the Democratic Senator Daniel Inouye from Hawaii, is a bipartisan attempt to upgrade the regulation of telecommunications industry so as to keep pace with fast technological changes. Other aspect of regulation discussed is the role of the so-called Universal Service Fund, which goals, as mandated by the 1996 Act, are to allow equal access to telecom services for underprivileged consumers, such as those in low-income, rural, insular, and high-cost areas. The major debate is whether the fund represents an excessive regulation that prevents the deployment of new technology. Senator DeMint of South Carolina says this is the case.
I'm less pleased with the Universal Service Fund section of the bill because it expands the USF without addressing the needed reforms on the distribution end. I believe that universal service subsidies play a critical role in bringing communication service to rural, high-cost areas. But in a communications industry that is growing more fiercely competitive each day, Congress should really struggle to keep Universal Service Fund minimum, because fundamentally USF has been set up to help narrowly defined groups at the expense of consumers as a whole.
Finally, and by far the most controversial aspect of the bill, concerns net neutrality, or non-discriminatory access of all users to the Internet that is not impeded by broadband taxes. Net neutrality proponents say the bill would create a two-tiered system that could allow broadband providers to charge extra for preferential and speedier delivery of Internet content. Democratic Senator from California Boxer strongly supported provisions of the bill that would uphold maximum net neutrality possible.
If we don't do this right, we're going to have a lot of people not able to access the Internet, and it's a very unfair system. Mr. Chairman, I would say if we don't do something on net neutrality, it would be akin to you're going to take your car onto the highway. You've done it every day. You've got 15 minutes to get to work. You're blocked from getting on the highway. Suddenly a car comes behind and all the trucks that are blocking the highway part for that car. You think it's time for you and you still can't get on the highway.
However, Republican Senator Sununu of New Hampshire opposes neutrality-related or any other regulation of the industry.
We don't know where the industry is headed or technologies are headed or services are headed. And for that very reason, we should be very careful and reluctant to regulate the Internet. We should be very careful and reluctant to create technology mandates, and there are some in this bill.
Democratic Representative Markey from Massachusetts held a news conference today in which he presented his amendment to ensure strong Internet neutrality provisions that would prevent what he calls stifling the openness of the net by creating broadband haves and have-nots.
We have no problem if one consumer wants super high bandwidth and wants to pay $100 a month for it, while another only needs $20 a month speed. But once they buy their connection to the Internet, don't start to limit access to certain content based on whether those Internet destinations also paid new fees and broadband taxes to the telephone companies.
His initiative was supported by the musician Moby, who was speaking on behalf of artistic community.
And there's a reason that people's favorite websites such as Google, Amazon, eBay, Craigslist are all fighting together to preserve net neutrality. If Congress guts net neutrality, independent music and news sites would be choked off. Consumer choice would be limited and the Internet will become a private toll road auctioned off by companies like AT&T. And that's why there's this huge, huge public backlash going on.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Anastasia Gnizditska in Washington, D.C.
At his confirmation hearing for CIA Director Michael Hayden insisted that the National Security Agency's surveillance program is legal.
He also deferred many questions, saying he would answer them when the committee recesses into a closed session. Furthermore, he defended the U.S.'s treatment of detainees, saying the U.S. follows the law. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports.
While being questioned by Democratic Senator Carl Levin from Michigan, Lieutenant General Michael Hayden said he was an integral part in the creation of the domestic wiretapping program as head of the National Security Agency.
As I said to Senator Bond, my role was, here's technologically possible, and if we could pull that off, here's what I think the operational relevance would be. And there then followed a discussion as to why or how we could make that possible. I was issued an order on the 4th of October that laid out the underpinnings for what I described.
So you participated in the design of the specific program?
Yes, I think that's fair, Senator, yeah.
Hayden went on to defend the program, insisting on its legality. Hayden was questioned mostly about the NSA wiretapping program. Some senators on the Intelligence Committee support the program, and that was made known in their questioning. Chair of the committee, Pat Roberts.
I believe that the NSA terrorist surveillance program is legal. It is necessary, and without it, the American people would be less safe.
Roberts defended the program and Hayden's role several times during the hearing. But others expressed concern, but many questions were deflected, with Hayden saying that he will give an answer in a closed session that is to follow the public hearing. Senator Levin.
He confirmed
is that the whole program?
Senator, I'm not at liberty to talk about that in open session.
I'm not asking you what the program is. I'm just simply saying is what the president described publicly, the whole program.
Senator, all I'm at liberty to say in this session is what I was talking about.
That was also his answer when asked why the NSA didn't use the courts of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. Caroline Fredrickson is the director of the American Civil Liberties Union.
Well, so none of us is ever going to know whether actually he even is forthcoming in that setting. And many of the questions that were asked, I think most of us would think, are appropriately dealt with in the front of the public. They weren't asking about technical details of the program. They weren't asking about classified information. They were simply asking him about whether or not the CIA was going to abide by the law in many cases and whether the NSA had done so in the past.
Although much of the committee focused on Hayden's role at the NSA, some questions steered toward the CIA's policy on the treatment of detainees in U.S.-run prisons around the world. But most questions about detainees, Hayden said he would answer behind closed doors. Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein from California.
As principal deputy to the DNI, is it your policy that individuals may be secretly detained for decades?
Let me give you a full answer, ma'am, and let me give it to you in the closed session, but I would really be happy to answer your question.
Do you believe that the CIA is legally bound by the federal anti-torture statute and the Detainee Treatment Act adopted last year?
Yes, ma'am.
Does the president's signing statement affect CIA's compliance with this law?
Again, ma'am, I don't want to get between Article 1 and Article 2 and the inherent tensions between those, but let me answer the question as the potential director of the Central Intelligence Agency. The CIA will obey the laws of the United States and will respond to our treaty obligations.
Last year, the president added a signing statement to the McCain torture bill that said he could sidestep torture laws at any time. Hayden says the torture law applies only to Department of Defense-run facilities.
Again, the legislation does not explicitly or implicitly, I believe, bind anyone beyond the Department of Defense, Senator.
Avidan Kover is with Human Rights First. He appeared on Pacifica's live coverage of the hearing. He said Hayden's dismissal of the questions causes the public to wonder what the CIA is doing.
But what is the CIA doing? Do we pass these laws and then the CIA creates its own rules? Are the same laws, the treaties that we believe bind both the military and law enforcement, not binding on the CIA?
A majority of senators on the committee have expressed support for Hayden as CIA director before today's hearing, signaling that his confirmation is likely. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
The Senate has voted to build a big fence along parts of the Mexican border to prevent undocumented workers from entering the country. In total, 370 miles of triple-layered barriers, which includes razor, would be added near San Diego and in the Arizona desert. Senators also improved a provision that would prevent immigrants from petitioning for a guest worker permit without the sponsorship of an employer. And in a unanimous vote, the Senate accepted an amendment that would bar granting work permits to undocumented workers convicted of either a felony or at least three misdemeanors. The measure also would affect those who ignored a court deportation order.
The New York Times reports that Lockheed Martin, Raytheon, and Northrop Grumman, three of the U.S. largest military contractors, are among the companies bidding for a multi-billion dollar federal contract to build what the Bush administration calls a virtual fence. This will be along the U.S.-Mexico border. The companies are expected to use the same kinds of technologies they use in their Iraq and Afghanistan security contracts, such as robotic aerial vehicles, ground surveillance satellites, and motion detection video equipment. The virtual fence appears to have many factors in common with the old Berlin Wall. More surprisingly, in its new initiative, the Bush administration is asking contractors to devise and build a whole new border strategy that ties together the personnel, technology, and physical barriers. Earlier this year, Homeland Security Deputy Secretary Michael Jackson told military industry leaders, quote, "We're asking you to come back and tell us how to do our business," end quote.
In Oklahoma today, 16 people were arrested outside the annual meeting of the oil and gas services company called Halliburton. The demonstrators were charged with trespassing after they left the designated protest area to attempt what they called a citizen's arrest on Halliburton chief executive Barry Lazar. Meanwhile, inside the meeting, shareholders rejected a proposal by a group of Texas and Kansas shareholders to adopt a policy based on the Universal Declaration of Human Rights.
The current time is 5:42, and now it's time for Daily Commentary with Jim Hightower.
Bush World seems to be a topsy-turvy place in which right and wrong can switch places overnight, and principles are as permanent as yesterday's weather. It seems like only yesterday, for example, that the entire Bush-Cheney regime was not merely defying the authority of the United Nations, but openly ridiculing it. In the run-up to their Iraq attack, they were calling the UN everything from irrelevant to wimpy, declaring that even if that body's Security Council refused to pass a war resolution against Iraq, the U.S. would attack anyway. The Bushites asserted that they had the right to disregard the will of the UN whenever they pleased. Today, however, what was right has become wrong in Bush world. This time, it's Iran that says it, too, has the sovereign right to ignore the UN and will continue to develop its nuclear capability even if the Security Council formally condemns it. So, doing a 180-degree reversal, the Bushites are now championing the authority of the very international body they had been stiffing. Here's how Condi Rice put it, supposedly with a straight face. "The Security Council is the primary and most important institution of peace and stability and security, and it cannot have its will simply ignored by a member state." Another example is George W.'s recent flip-flop on gas-guzzling vehicles. Faced with an explosion of public anger over skyrocketing gas prices, Bush suddenly has become consumer man, scolding both the oil and automobile industries for not improving the fuel efficiency of our cars and trucks. But wait, consumer man, weren't you the guy who furiously demanded that Congress kill a provision in last year's energy bill that would have required greater fuel efficiency? Why, yes, you were. This is Jim Hightower saying, in Bush world, what's right can quickly become wrong, and wrong can turn into right, depending on the prevailing political winds. Today's commentary is made possible in part by the good folks at Mother Jones Magazine. Over the years, Mother Jones has won just about every award available while ticking off the honchos of business and government. They're proud of both distinctions. Find out more at MotherJones.com.
Stay tuned for independent native news following our newscast tonight. And at 6, here, Proverbial Perspectives with Celeste Carey. At 7, it's Good Times with the Swanky Cap Guy, Reggae Bop. And the weather. Enjoy the warmth and smog because the rain is coming to Portland, Corvallis, and Vancouver this weekend. And it's going to be partly sunny in the Willamette Valley through Friday, with highs dropping now to the low 70s, and in the Columbia Gorge, cloudy for the rest of the week with highs around 70, with no rain in the gorge this weekend, but lows in the 60s. You are listening to the handcrafted K-Boo Evening News for Portland, Corvallis, Vancouver, and Hood River.
Italy's new Prime Minister Romano Prodi called the U.S. invasion and occupation of Iraq a, quote, grave error, and said he would propose a withdrawal of Italian troops. Italy has about 3,000 troops in Iraq in what are called peacekeeping roles. They are already due to be withdrawn in groups before the end of the year. Prodi's coalition narrowly defeated former Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi in an election last month. Berlusconi has been among President Bush's most ardent European boosters. Bush is losing allies from the so-called Coalition of the Willing. The party of Spain's Prime Minister José María Aznar was ousted in 2004 by voters upset in part by troop deployments in Iraq. The Prime Minister of Portugal, who stood next to Bush days before the invasion, resigned months later for another job.
Iraq's Prime Minister-designate Nouri Maliki is to present his cabinet 5 days ahead of a constitutional deadline. Maliki is reportedly close to finalizing the line and will present the new cabinet to Parliament this Saturday. The formation of a working government has been stalled a number of times because Shia, Sunni Arabs, and Kurds have failed to agree on its makeup since last December's elections.
In a move seen as a widening of the gap between the legislative and executive branches of the Palestinian government, Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas has deployed over thousands of police throughout the Gaza Strip. Manar Jibrin reports.
The massive police deployment came just hours after the Hamas-led government sent its own special security force into Gaza streets. The new controversial special forces are made up of 3,000 men. Most are members of the Al-Qassam Brigade, the armed wing of Hamas. The new force is led by Jamal Abu Samahdana, who is wanted by the Israeli army for his role in the armed popular resistance committees. Hamas says that the security force was formed to support the police forces and other security units and to stop the chaos and instability
in areas. And salaried persons, both in public and private sectors, trading community and business houses, constitute the third source of their funds.
Sanjeev Kumar, a teacher in the southern Naples district school, says that even a person like him, with meager salary of 5,000 rupees, has to pay 20% of it per month as protection toll to the Maoists, which they call donation.
Maoists tell us that they are running people's government since we pay tax to the royal government. And what is the problem giving something to the people's government?
Maoist Chief Pasinda, however, has a unique antidote against their extortion spree.
This government was formed due to the power of people's movement. It should allocate 50% of its budget for development of rural people and upkeep of our people's army. This is our claim.
Pasinda's such a statement gives an inkling that Maoists are in a position to dictate terms to the political elites now perched at the helm of government because of their armed cadres. The political elites, heading the constituents of the Seven Parties Alliance, don't wield enough clout to win mass votes at any future hustings, which would be held sooner or later. There looms a big possibility that Maoists would eventually grab control of now all-powerful parliament and form a government of their own. The political parties are threatened with a peripheral role in the polity of the country in the long run. Maoists may shun annihilating the political parties because they have to front to the world that they are wedded to multi-party democracy and electoral politics. Ravikant Mishra, a political analyst, envisages such a political scenario and explains the reasons for it too.
The seven-party alliance leaders are in jubilation at the moment.
But gradually Maoists would overwhelm them because Maoists have far, far better political and military networks with committed and honest cadres. They garner billions of rupees every year, though through dubious means, but they are very transparent and equitable in sharing the booty. But the political parties are mere paper organizations, full of mercenary elements, who always remain on the prowl to loot their state coffers. Against this backdrop, I can vividly see that both multi-party democracy and monarchy are in jeopardy. Maoists are going to rule the country. I don't know it will be good or bad for the country. We can only wait and watch how the future unfolds.
It appears the government may not be in a position to comply with the demand of separate budgetary allocation for the Maoist guerrillas, and their extortion spree would continue. Even if the Maoist government peace talks succeed and the guerrillas relinquish arms, the people in remote parts of the country would not be able to shed off the fear psychosis they have been living with for past 10 years of Maoist insurgency. From Kathmandu, I'm P.C. Dubey for Free Speech Radio News.
If you have any questions or comments or whatever about what you heard this evening, please call us at 503-318-0032 and leave us a message on extension 203 or send us an email to pmnews@kboo.org. You're listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Corvallis at 100.7 FM on translator K264 AA, and in the Hood River at 91.9 FM on translator K220HR. You can log on to our website at kboo.fm. Our producer for tonight's newscast is Lisa Loving. Tonight's audio editor is Josh Johnson. Tonight's AP Wire editor is Ross Egan. And special thanks go to reporters Spencer Raymond, Stephanie Potter, and Jessica Rink Perry. Our engineer is Josh Johnson. And the Cable Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. And I continue to be Eduardo de Landeros Tierra.
And I continue to be Marlies Franklin. And I'd like to invite you to stay tuned for our independent Native news and join us tomorrow morning at 7 a.m. for the KBOO Morning News. At 7:30, Ani and Melody host Positively Revolting Talk Radio. The guests are Helen Sherman and Frances O'Halloran. They'll talk about gentrification and women in the NAACP. At 9 on Marlena's Electronic Salon, Marlena and Ed Goldberg discuss politics and culture, and later Marlena speaks with shaman and teacher Martin Presto, whose new book is The Disobedience of the Daughter of the Sun, Ecstasy and Time. At 11 o'clock, it's Democracy Now!, and that's all right here for you on KBOO. This is your nonprofit, volunteer-powered, listener-sponsored, handcrafted, and listener-sponsored and handcrafted. I said that already. Community Radio, thank you for joining us.
This is Independent Native News for Thursday, the 18th of May. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock. The committee investigating the allegations of academic misconduct by a University of Colorado ethnic studies professor released its report on Tuesday. Ward Churchill has been under investigation for allegations of plagiarism and academic misrepresentation. Churchill has written extensively on Native American history. However, some critics say that he fabricated his own Native ethnicity. Last week, Churchill's wife and fellow Ethnic Studies Associate Professor Natsu Taylor Sato submitted her resignation to CU, citing the university's treatment of Churchill and disputes with the Ethnic Studies Department among her reasons. From KGNU in Boulder, Maeve Conran has more.
Professor Marianne Wesson, the chair of the investigative committee, says there were concerns about the timing of the investigation, which coincided with the controversy over Churchill's writings on 9/11.
These essays played no part in our deliberations, but we do express our concern regarding the timing and perhaps the motives for the university's decision to forward the charges that were made in that context.
The university says that the investigation had nothing to do with Churchill's controversial writings, but rather the controversy was a catalyst for the other complaints. Churchill was accused of 7 counts of plagiarism and misrepresentation in his writings on Native American history. The committee found that he committed several forms of academic misconduct.
We do note additionally that Professor Churchill was disrespectful of Indian oral traditions when dealing with the Mandan Fort Clark smallpox epidemic of 1837, both in his essays and during the course of his investigation.
Two allegations which dealt with copyright issues and Churchill's Native American ethnicity were rejected by the committee as not being relevant to an investigation into academic misconduct. Throughout the course of the investigation, Churchill has repeatedly rejected the questioning of his Native American heritage and has been supported by the Colorado American Indian Movement. Following the release of the report, Churchill released a statement saying he will reject and contest each and every finding of misconduct and questioned the fact that the panel included neither American Indian scholars nor persons competent in American Indian studies. The university says it expects an official response from Churchill within the next 2 weeks. For Independent Native News, this is Maeve Conran in Boulder.
The provincial government in the province of British Columbia has signed an agreement with its Métis community. As Craig McCulloch reports, the agreement is expected to be a major stepping stone towards reducing inequality between the Métis and the general population.
The Métis Nation Relationship Accord is a follow-up to a larger agreement signed with Canada's major political and native leaders this past fall. Although that deal, called the Kelowna Agreement after the city where it was signed, has not been endorsed by the new Conservative government in Ottawa, the provincial British Columbia government has pledged to proceed with its commitments. Métis are offspring of mixed European-Aboriginal relationships. The most recent accord sets goals to reduce the gap between Métis and the general population in areas of healthcare, housing, education, and employment. Keith Henry is the CEO of the Métis Nation of British Columbia, a group comprised of 35 community associations across British Columbia, which represents some 16,000 people over the age of 18. He says their concerns are not rights-based, but concern recognition. He hopes the agreement will help reduce the economic inequities faced by Métis individuals in British Columbia.
I think this agreement for us really makes sure that the provincial government understands that there is a Métis Nation here, and they show, and by them agreeing to sign this accord, they've shown that that respect that there isn't Métis community in BC, and regardless of the rights-based agenda, there's still high unemployment, there's still realities that we're facing in terms of income levels and these sorts of things that have to be, you know, we have to achieve parity so that the Métis community is a productive part of British Columbia and Canada.
Henry says the Métis population faces 11% unemployment, significantly higher than the 4.5% of the general provincial population. The accord also involves Métis identification and data collection. According to Henry, this will allow them to identify Métis citizenship within British Columbia. It is hoped this would give a clear picture of how many Métis individuals currently reside in the province and other statistics. I'm Craig McCulloch in Vancouver.
This is Independent Native News. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock.
Supported by Ridolfi Incorporated, designing and implementing restorative community development. RIDOLFI.com. Independent Native News is a production of KUAC at the University of Alaska Fairbanks.